Welcome to Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton, where we equip pastors to take their churches from declining to thriving by pointing them to a new future and a new hope. Join us weekly for encouragement and practical advice in your pastoring journey.
This is Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton.
This is Revitalize and Replant without a net today.
Yeah, we are.
Normally, we don't have much of a net. It's a pretty small net.
Yeah, well.
We just kind of get on here and do whatever we want.
I am the only one who knows what we're talking about.
But this
about
is
today.
Dan Hurst, our great announcer.
That's Kyle Bierman over there.
And today, it's questions from the audience.
Yeah.
We've got a room full of people here today.
Yeah.
And they're going to ask questions. So Kyle's going to...
I feel like Carol Burnett.
We're going to... Yeah. Carol Burnett.
I don't know where that came from.
1977,
sorry.
Bro. You are so old.
I know. You have sent questions to us or comments, you know, and we thought, well,
I'm so glad we had this time together. Just
now,
to
here's
have a laugh or sing a song.
Here are the guidelines.
We just get started.
Would you
and
stop?
Before you know it, so long, good night.
We're getting on the verge of copyright infringement.
Carol Burnett would sing that at the end of every one of her shows.
We now have to pay royalties for that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Go ahead.
Also, what we're going to do today, Kyle has the comments and questions.
Look it up on YouTube. Carol Burnett singing good night.
It's Revitalize and Replant with Mark Clifton, ladies and gentlemen.
What are we doing today? I wasn't listening.
We don't know. That's the thing.
Okay.
Kyle is going to throw questions at us that have been submitted by listeners.
All right.
And we don't even know what the questions are.
Yeah, that's right. I alone have these.
All right. They've been sealed in a mayonnaise jar in the back on Funk and Wagnall's back porch.
All right, Johnny Carson.
All right. And so here's the first, and I'm not going to throw out the names of those who asked it, but here's the first one. If you go to a church where the pastor is the guy, solo pastor church, he asks, how do you begin finding and building up specifically men who can practically assist you in the work, decision-making, shepherding the flock? Maybe the church isn't to a place where they would want to have a plurality of elders. Maybe they're not ready for that. But how do you begin the process of identifying and raising up leaders
if you're the pastor?
Well, I think what's behind this question is there's a lot of guys out there who listen to us who are going to dying churches and they would like to create a new church governance,
right?
That basically has elders. Let's be honest about that. So I'm not saying whether I'm not here to tell you should or you shouldn't. There are Southern Baptist churches who have both. I will say sometimes, guys, if you quit using the word elder, it might be a lot easier on you. When I was at Warnell, I didn't raise up elders. I raised up lay pastors or pastor leaders. And that word communicated much better what we wanted to do and wasn't as off-putting to those who had a different view of what elders were.
Because there are sections of the country where as soon as somebody hears elders, they think Presbyterian or Church of Christ.
And
when
I said we're going to raise up some laymen to help me pastor the church or pastor leaders and explained what that was, well, yeah, that was a good idea. However you want to raise up men to help you lead the church, first of all, you got to realize that is your job. Yeah. I mean, and you may have to actually take a really long on-ramp, and you may have to find some way to lead some young man in your neighborhood or your community to Christ, disciple him, and help him become a leader. It may take 5, 7, 8, 10 years. I don't have anything to tell you how in 6 months you can find three guys to be key leaders in your church. It is a process of, if nothing else, through conversion action, bringing them to that, or through personal discipleship in your church. Is there a couple of guys there that you can spend a little more time with on a weekly basis, walking with them through God's word, giving them small responsibilities, and then helping them understand how that worked and seeing how well they could do? Think of it as like a minor league pitcher. Don't give them a lot to do all at once. Give them little things and help them evaluate. Did you like that? Was it good for you? Did you learn from it? And always be giving them plenty of resources and things to read, things to look at, podcasts to listen to. Just be intentional about trying to develop. And you say, oh, I don't have anybody like that in my church. Well, then, guys, go coach a little league team in your community. Go volunteer someplace. Find some way at a coffee shop to get to know the barista. Find some way to lend someone to Christ. I mean, that's what you have to do. There's no 1-800 get me an elder. I can't do that for you. But it can be done over time. Just maybe take a slower on ramp and realize this may take several years even to get the first one. But be intentional about it.
I think it also helps if you prioritize the needs, the specific needs of that particular church, of that culture, you know, at that particular time. And if you know what needs really, really have to be prioritized at the top, it also gives you a sense of who you're looking for, you know, that can help you and take you to that point. Because it may very, very well be that somebody else is looking for that ministry and you don't even know it.
And maybe one of the places you can start is to have a men's Saturday morning men's retreat, maybe a whole weekend, but that may be a bridge too far. I don't mean a men's Baptist men's breakfast. I mean, you may want to do that, but those have been done a lot. But I'm talking about maybe Saturday from, I don't know, 9 to noon, and you bring in some kind of a Bible teacher, and you'd really do an in-depth look at the book of Jonah, or an in-depth look at maybe the epistle of 1 John or something. And you see who in that group seems to really kind of be hungry for this, and mm-hmm. start having some things like that so you can look at it through your eyes and go, you know, Carl here, he really seemed to get into that study of the book of Jonah, or maybe this young man, or maybe this older man. So have some ways where you do some things where you're really getting into God's word as men. And then there is a little book, and Kyle will put a link to it. It's very simple. Very basic. Some of you will think it's too basic. It basically kind of comes from Navigators. It's called Every Man a Warrior. Mm-hmm. Every Man a Warrior. And its idea is to get men to read the Bible together. So maybe before you try to get elders or deacons or whatever you're trying to get, lay pastors, just try to get two or three guys to meet with you to read the Bible together every week and use this Every Man a Warrior book and see which of them. Once men start reading the Bible, that's a beginning to develop them into some kind of leaders. So check that resource out.
And I'll say this too. You talk a lot about raising up leaders in Reclaiming Glory. I know you didn't plug your own book, so I'll plug it because that was extremely helpful for me 7 or 8 years ago when I was starting in a new church. So if you've not already done so, get Reclaiming Glory because Mark dives a lot more into how to raise up leaders and how you did it at Warnall as well.
There's another thing that I found extremely helpful in my ministry, and that is I really listen to the questions.
Well, that's good.
That the men are asking.
That's real good.
When men start asking questions, they're not just thinking up questions to ask.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're asking questions because there's something that they're dealing with.
Yep.
And if I know what their questions are, then I know what their ministry is, where their ministry may be headed.
That's a good question.
And
that's
so
a good
it's
point.
It's critical for them to listen to their questions. And why did they ask that question?
Yeah.
All right.
All right, here's the next one.
Yep.
How can or should you leverage parachurch organizations to help in the process of replanting revitalization? So, FCA,
sure.
Crew,
whatever,
Children Evangelism Fellowship.
I could
whatever.
See this all over your face. You're struggling with this one.
Dan and I are much older than you, and we've been around a lot longer. And the pendulum of parachurch among Southern Baptists has swung back and forth from intense partnership with parachurch to total fear and running away from parachurch to intense partners. It just goes back and forth and mm-hmm. back and forth. You know, I will say when I was in Montreal and we were in, you know, a highly secular culture, most unreached culture in North America, and I was on the campus of McGill University. They call that kind of the Harvard of Canada, you know, right downtown Montreal. Man, I leaned in to Crew.
Oh, Campus Crusade.
And to Athletes in Action.
Yep.
Those two, man, I leaned into them.
Yeah.
And I found in them tremendous partners for evangelism on that campus. And those two didn't have a church, but I was a church. And so we became a church literally on the campus. And our initial converts came right from Crew and from Athletes in Action. And I saw great partnership among that. But that was almost in a kind of a foreign mission context in Montreal, you know, not right here in the deep south someplace. But here we have Youth for Christ,
yeah.
Or you have Fellowship of Christian Athletes, yep. And the tension has always been, does it compete with the youth group? Does it compete with your church? Are your kids involved in that instead of the other?
Yeah.
But here's what I would say, guys. You know, as we do this podcast right now, the fourth Luzerne conference is going on right now. I think it's in Korea, but I'm not sure where.
Yep.
And some people I know are there, and I'm following on Facebook. And in many ways, the Luzerne conference has sort of been the bellwether to say if a group or a church is a part of this, it's basically within mainstream evangelical orthodoxy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would say as long as a parachurch is part of that, given the cultural headwinds that we face today and the challenges we face in our world, this is not a time to pull away and compete with them. I think it's a time to find however we can to work together for the good of the gospel and for raising up Christian leaders.
And you have to ask the question, what's their intent?
You know,
what's the parachurch group? What is their intent to support the church?
Yes.
Or is it to be the church?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think you joked that my face apparently showed some concern earlier. And I think that was where I was trying to get was, how do we express, like, because there are, you don't want to partner with a parachurch organization that's content to leech off the church, right? You want it to support the church, which is the New Testament model, right?
Right.
So you have parachurch, meaning coming alongside the church, not trying to operate instead of the local church.
Yeah, and that's the key. That's, you know, I remember down on the mission field, used parachurch.
You were raised in Honduras.
I was raised in
Honduras.
Your
parents were missionaries in Honduras.
Yeah, and I remember Dad embraced parachurch organizations for specific ministry purposes. You know, it wasn't like, oh yeah, you know, you can be equal with us. It wasn't that sort of thing at all. And I remember having a conversation with him about this very thing, about when do you decide it's okay to use an organization? And he said, when is it not? Mm-hmm. He said, that's where you start. When is it not okay? And he said, you start figuring that out by what is their intent, what is their purpose.
Yeah.
And he said, I just look at them as a tool.
Yeah.
And he said, they're a tool for ministry. That's my responsibility, is to accomplish a ministry. Yeah, and if I can use them to do that, then why not?
And, you know, I'm biased because I grew up in the 1970s in Kansas City area. And Youth for Christ in Kansas City was unlike Youth for Christ anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
You don't have any idea, Kyle. You have no earthly idea.
I've read Billy Graham's biography.
No, you have no idea. Youth for Christ Kansas City was a separate organization from Youth for Christ in America.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Unique to Kansas City.
Okay.
And every Saturday night, 1,000 teenagers from across Kansas City would show up for a big rally on Saturday night. And it was an evangelistic rally. It was a Jesus rally. And I can't tell you how many Saturday nights I just went, you know, with my friends. It was something to do. Every Saturday night was the big rally. And then they had all kinds of other activities and events around the city. And it really created an environment where, because Al Metzger was the leader, that's a whole other story for another day, man. He loved the local church. And he did not, in my opinion, he did not try to be the local church. And I think there were a lot of times when smaller churches had no youth groups at all, and they were able to really lean into Youth for Christ. And Youth for Christ had some training. There's two or three pastors in our association who went through QB, Christ Unlimited Bible Institute, right? That was, I'm not saying it was always perfect, but, you know, it was a time when the churches seemed to work together. And now we talk about the Sin Network and stuff. Yeah. It's all about the brotherhood. It's all about reaching the city. Well, how are you going to do that if you just say, well, we don't work with anybody but ourselves?
No, in fact, those Youth for Christ is a perfect example, Kansas City Youth for Christ. They created a program to specifically begin developing and discipling guys who thought they wanted to go into the ministry.
Right.
And so there are lots of pastors these days. I got a guy in our church who is a retired pastor who started that.
Yeah.
So there was a parachurch organization that had a heart for the church.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I think this principle, so if for a lot of listeners who may be in smaller rural communities, there's probably not a ton of parachurch ministries in that. Maybe a maybe an FCA that meets at the school. But I think the same principle applies to the other churches in your community.
Sure.
Right? So you're not going to be able to partner with other denominations for everything.
Right.
But I think you've got to ask the question, okay, what can we do together? What can we do to show the community that we are on the same team, that we're not in competition with one another? How can we partner together? And there'll be some things that you just say, we can't on these things. But I think you go in with an open hand saying, what are the things that we can partner together for?
Next question.
Next question is, Mark, you talk a lot about in the work of replanting, so much of the low-hanging evangelical fruit is not going to come, right?
That's right.
So folks, typically in a church replant, like, you're not going to get folks who just moved to town and they're looking for a good thriving church.
Right.
So that means if the church is going to grow, you're going to be sharing the gospel with people. And that means sometimes you're going to have folks coming into your church who have no background in church whatsoever.
Yeah.
Have train wrecks of lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
So how do you prepare your congregation to minister to and disciple people who come from messy backgrounds?
That's a good question.
Where, I mean, they might walk into the church for the first time on the Sunday if they're baptized, right?
That's a good question. Here's what you have to do, guys. And when I say low-hanging evangelical fruit, I you know, Rainer doesn't like that term. He doesn't think it makes any sense. But what I'm talking about is people, like he said, who just show up in the neighborhood, they're already Christians, they're looking for a church home. They're probably going to go to one of the larger churches that can provide the resources they're looking for. So in the past, they may have come to your church because it was the closest church to them geographically. That's not the case anymore. So if a neighborhood church that's struggling is going to survive, you're going to survive by doing what you should do in the first place, which is missions and evangelism, ministry to people, leading them to Christ, discipling them. And as my brother has pointed out, many of them have very messy lives. You'll probably have many couples who come and worship with you who live together.
Yeah.
They're not Christians yet, but they're living together, right? And they're going to sit across from your kids at some church picnic, and your kids are going to see that this guy and his woman, they're not married, but they live together, but they come to our church. Now, they're not members. They're not even Christians, but they're living together, and they're coming to our church. And maybe they have kids together.
Yeah.
And the kids know my mom and dad are not married. It's one thing. Another thing, you may have guys come in who, you know, our friend Jimbo Stewart talked about, you know, he had this grandmother who would bring her grandchild to church, and the first couple Sundays she was there, she was an alcoholic, and she was drunk when she came. She was definitely on alcohol when she came. And he said even the third and fourth Sunday, she wasn't really drunk, but she reeked of it. You know, so you sit down next to somebody and you reek of alcohol, right? You reek of marijuana smoke when you walk in. Maybe they stand outside. You know, marijuana is legal in many states now. And before they come in, instead of smoking a Winston, they're doing a joint. What do you call it? You know, Dan. Whatever this
what
stuff
are you
is.
At me like?
I don't know. I'm just asking.
What do you call it?
You know, like Bogart a joint.
You just assumed you knew, Dan.
They're Bogarting a joint before they walk in or whatever. By the way, the Doobie Brothers. I didn't realize. I was like 30 years old before I knew that Doobie was. I thought it was their last name.
I'm Joe Doobie.
Joe Doobie. It's the Doobie Brothers, like the Blackwood Brothers. Oh, anyway, but
the Statler Brothers weren't brothers
but
either.
It is. I'm not. The reality is here's the deal. It goes back many. I take it to the. When I'm doing this with the church and Linwood, we've got some people in Linwood that have some messy lives for sure, right? And we have people in Linwood who've been in church all their life. So you get those two things together. Here's the key. The main difference between the priest, the Levite, and the Samaritan was one word, and that word was compassion.
Ooh.
So you have to help your people become compassionate for the lost, not just want to grow the church. That's not the same thing. Yeah. Compassionate for the lost. And it was the compassion of the Samaritan that drove him to sacrifice his comfort, his money, everything. And so you're going to have to prepare your people to sacrifice. And you do that by leading them to the fact that Jesus sacrificed all of his comfort for us. Yeah. And compared to Jesus, we're far more messier than these people who are showing up here. So you got to do that through discipleship, through preaching, through teaching, through preparing them, and then through just-in-time teaching when they kind of recoil at these people who've come in, you do not let that go. That's a teaching moment to get those folks aside and say, let me tell you why we're doing what we're doing. And if you can't handle this, then this isn't the church for you. You've got to make the decision now that we are going to reach these people rather than not reach them in order to keep the ones we have.
And, you know, we say often that in order to revitalize the church, you've got to be willing to be fired to see the church come back to life. I think this is a key area. If you're going to reach your neighborhood, and that's a passion, you've got to be willing to be fired over that.
Yeah.
I knew a pastor. I'm not going to give his name, but he was in a community and he started reaching biker gangs. The biggest tattoo artist in town got saved and he was connected to all these biker guys. And so he started telling his biker friends about Jesus and they showed up to a white collar First Baptist church, mm-hmm. In their biker t-shirts because that's what they had. Right. Yeah. And the church was okay with it until they realized, wait, these folks are staying. Like, they're not going to go off and do their own church. These folks are staying. And it started to change the culture of their First Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And that pastor actually ended up losing his job and moving to another church in town that was welcoming these folks with open arms because First Baptist said, these are not our people.
Well, here's a real challenge, and then we'll get to the next question. But I was in a meeting recently with an older church and a newer church, and they were talking about maybe merging. And the newer church said, you know, we're reaching a lot of people that are on the fringes. And so I just brought it up. I said, do you have, because I knew they did, I said, do you have transgender people in your worship service? And the older church looked at me like, why would you ask such a question? Mm-hmm. And the newer church looked at me like, well, of course we do. Mm-hmm. And he said, sure. And I said, well, tell me about that. He said, we have a lot of transgender students, teenagers mm-hmm. and college students. And he said, we want to welcome them because we don't want the only place they feel welcome to be with the other transgenders on the campus. We want them to know that we welcome them and we love them too. And he said, you know, sharing the gospel with them is a long process, a challenging process, a time-consuming process, a patient process. But why would we want to remove them? And of course, the other side said, well, but they're there with your own children. How confusing is that? Look, guys, I'm telling you, we're going to live in a world where if you really want to reach this lost world, you got to deal with these issues. What are you going to do? You're going to say you can't come in here because you're transgender. I get that some people would say that. But I get what the other pastor says, and well, then you're just pushing them out. And only people that will love them are the people who are really harming them. And they're confused anyway and all that. So it becomes a real issue with how do you prepare a normative-sized church to deal with what's coming if you do reach this culture. Now, I want to be clear. Even this new church said, you know, in order for them to come to faith in Christ and be baptized and be a member, they get all that straightened out. But we don't ask them to straighten it out before they start showing up and worshiping with us. Yeah.
I tell my people, look, it's how you define love. You know, it's, you know, if we're to love one another and we know we believe that, then how do you define love?
Yeah.
And the practical way to define it is allowing God to do something in somebody else's life through you. Mm. And so that's what I tell them. You know, we got messy people. I'll tell you, we have a room full of messy people, you know, in my church. And I just tell them, you know, our job is to allow God to do something in their life through us. So what's God doing through you?
And by the way, guys, you don't have to compromise the truth.
Exactly.
In fact, it's okay. I mean, I never compromise it. I never compromise truth on human sexuality, on biblical marriage, on gender identification. You don't have to compromise the truth. You just don't have to be mean about it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Ooh, that's good.
And they expect you, for example, if they were to walk into a mosque, they wouldn't expect the imam to go along with their view.
Yeah. Right.
They understand he sees the world differently. I think if they walk into your church, it's okay for them to realize this is our biblical view of the world, but that doesn't mean we don't love you and have compassion on you and we're confident in who we are and, you know, we're trying to. So I think I'm not telling you you've got to adapt to them. I'm telling you you've got to be true to the gospel and true to the scriptural fidelity, but love them, which is what Jesus would do.
I had a lady in our church who said this. She says, I come here not because I feel accepted, but because I feel loved.
Ooh.
And I said, well, explain that, you know, unpackage that for me. And she says, I know that people don't accept my lifestyle.
Right.
But she says, I do know that they love me.
Yeah.
Oh,
so that's
good.
The key.
It is. It really is.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Because I get this question a lot. So I want you in 2 minutes, for a pastor of a church who recognizes they need to be revitalized, but they don't know where to start, where do they start?
Well, I really do. I say I start with experiencing God. I know that sounds sort of maybe trite to some people, but man, experiencing God says God's at work all around us. He has been since the very beginning. He's at work in this neighborhood right now. Mm. The issue isn't that God's not at work. The issue is we don't recognize where he's working.
Oh, that's good.
And the reason I don't recognize where he's working is because I'm too focused on what I want and what my world is. And I've got to quit looking at that, and I've got to start seeing him. And in order to experience him, I have to learn to live by faith. I have to learn to lay down my preferences for his preferences. I think experiencing God helps us with all of that. So oftentimes I say begin with experiencing God. And then right after that, maybe flickering lamps and some other things like that. I mean, clearly, blinging with God's word, I know what you're saying, obviously, and right. preaching Jesus in every sermon, getting their hearts to warm to the gospel, getting to lay down the idol of the church as they know it and embrace Jesus only. But I really do think the experiencing God study helps people do that. Okay. And I believe that's a good place to start.
It's good. Thanks.
All right.
Are we going to wrap enough? That up? We're
That's
done?
It. That's all we have time for.
Okay, well, I just want you to know, I'm so glad we had this time together.
This is Revitalize and Replant with Carol Burnett.
Since we just get started, and before you know it,
he's just going to keep going.
Comes the time we have to say,
you just go out like the announcer. It's so the Carol Burnett long. Show.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us today on Revitalize and Replant. This podcast is brought to you by the North American Mission Board, where we help dying or struggling churches regain health for the glory of God and the good of their communities. If you found this conversation helpful, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform. To learn more about becoming a replanting pastor or to explore resources about revitalization for your own church, visit churchreplanters.com.